In April 1959, a striking contrast unfolded at Washington's Statler Hilton Hotel. Fidel Castro, still in his revolutionary olive-green fatigues, met with Acting Secretary of State Christian Herter in his formal three-piece suit. When introduced to the State Department official in charge of Cuban affairs, Castro quipped, "And I thought I was in charge of Cuban affairs." This clever joke signaled his intention to end a half-century of U.S. control over Cuban matters. The opening salvo in what would become the Western Hemisphere's most enduring diplomatic standoff. Despite the public rhetoric of hostility that has defined U.S.-Cuban relations for decades, every American administration, from Eisenhower to Obama, engaged in secret talks with Cuba. These hidden dialogues reveal a complex relationship far more nuanced than the frozen diplomatic posture suggests. The tension between geographic proximity and ideological distance created a paradox. Two nations unable to live together comfortably, yet incapable of living apart. What makes this diplomatic dance so fascinating is how consistently both sides reach toward each other while simultaneously pushing away, like porcupines attempting to mate, as one negotiator memorably described it. The relationship has been defined by missed opportunities, miscommunications, and moments when reconciliation seemed tantalizingly close, only to slip away. When Fidel Castro's revolutionary movement triumphed in January 1959, the Eisenhower administration initially adopted a cautious approach. Ambassador Philip Bonsall believed shared interests would moderate the revolution's radical tendencies. Castro's April 1959 visit to the United States represented perhaps the best opportunity to avoid a diplomatic rupture. Despite keeping their beards and olive-green uniforms, Castro and his entourage made a strong impression. Cheering crowds greeted him everywhere, and at the Bronx Zoo, he even jumped over a guardrail to playfully taunt tigers. Quintessential Fidel, boldly courting danger. Yet the official aspects of the visit failed. President Eisenhower deliberately snubbed Castro, choosing to golf in Georgia instead. More critically, neither side would initiate discussion about economic aid. Castro had instructed his team not to request assistance, believing the Americans would offer it unprompted. Meanwhile, U.S. officials, prepared to offer a $25 million loan, waited for the Cubans to raise the subject. In the end, the Cubans wouldn't ask, and the Americans didn't offer. Imagine how differently history might have unfolded if either side had swallowed their pride and extended their hand first. This pattern of mutual stubbornness would repeat for decades. On November 22, 1963, French journalist Jean Daniel was in Cuba carrying a message of potential reconciliation from President Kennedy to Fidel Castro. When Castro learned Kennedy had been shot in Dallas, he told Daniel, "This is an end to your mission of peace. Everything has changed." Kennedy's Cuba policy was contradictory. After the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, he authorized Operation Mongoose to overthrow Castro while secretly exploring accommodation with Cuba, calling it an exploration worth making. The first high-level contact came when Che Guevara approached White House aide Richard Goodwin in Uruguay, sending cigars with a note, "To write to the enemy is difficult. I limit myself to extending my hand." After criticizing the U.S. publicly, Guevara engaged Goodwin privately until dawn, presenting a proposal for a modus vivendi. By November 1963, Castro had invited U.S. envoy William Atwood to Cuba for direct talks. In his final days, Kennedy signaled openness to reconciliation, acknowledging America's sins in pre-revolutionary Cuba. This potential breakthrough died with his assassination. What if Kennedy had lived? Would the diplomatic thaw have continued? It remains one of history's great what-ifs, a moment when U.S.-Cuba relations might have taken a dramatically different course than the half-century of hostility that followed. Despite Nixon's intense dislike of Castro, practical realities forced communication. When airplane hijackings became epidemic between 1961 and 1972, with 173 of 325 worldwide hijackings diverted to Cuba, both nations negotiated an anti-hijacking agreement, a pattern of crises forcing pragmatic engagement despite ideological differences. Henry Kissinger eventually recognized isolation's counterproductivity, initiating secret contact with Cuba in 1974 without informing Nixon. The first meeting occurred in a LaGuardia Airport cafeteria where paranoid diplomats mistook a blind pen seller for a CIA operative. Jimmy Carter launched the most ambitious normalization effort, establishing interest sections in both capitals, but foundered on Cuba's military involvement in Africa. The relationship reached crisis with the 1980 Mario boatlift when 120,000 Cubans reached Florida amid conflicting policies. Carter later admitted that emphasizing Cuba's withdrawal from Ethiopia may have been excessive, missing an opportunity for full diplomatic relations. The pattern persisted. Potential breakthroughs undermined by external events, miscalculations, or domestic politics. Both sides repeatedly demanding complete capitulation rather than accepting incremental progress. Ronald Reagan entered office with Secretary of State Alexander Haig suggesting, "You just give me the word and I'll turn that fucking island into a parking lot." Yet even the staunchly anti-communist Reagan ultimately negotiated major agreements with Cuba on migration and southern Africa. The Cubans pursued military deterrence while simultaneously seeking diplomatic solutions, reducing arms shipments to Salvadoran rebels, supporting regional peace initiatives, and seeking direct talks with Washington. Bill Clinton personally understood the folly of the Cuba embargo, later confiding that anybody with half a brain could see the embargo was counterproductive. But politically, he recognized that the path to the White House ran through Florida. This tension between pragmatic foreign policy and domestic politics has constrained every administration's Cuba policy. Clinton's people-to-people approach expanded contacts through humanitarian, religious, and educational travel while maintaining the embargo. When thousands of desperate Cubans began fleeing on rafts in 1994, both leaders initiated secret back-channel communications, resulting in a migration agreement that demonstrated Cuba and the United States can reach agreement. Remarkably, progress often came not through grand diplomatic initiatives, but through quiet, person-to-person connections, journalists, academics, and religious leaders building more effective bridges than governments. At Nelson Mandela's memorial service in December 2013, Barack Obama and Raul Castro shared a historic handshake, the first public meeting between U.S. and Cuban presidents since 1959. This symbolic gesture came as Obama acknowledged that policies from 1961 made little sense in the age of the internet, while Raul expressed his desire for civilized relations through respectful dialogue. The history of U.S.-Cuba dialogue reveals consistent patterns. Domestic politics constrains both sides. Bureaucratic misunderstandings proliferate as neither comprehends the other system, and Cuba insists on being treated as an equal sovereign nation. Since 1959, Cuba has demanded mutual respect and reciprocal benefits in any dialogue. Despite their antagonism, geographic proximity provides both the source of conflict and the impetus for reconciliation, as the nations become increasingly interconnected through trade, travel, and family ties. The U.S.-Cuban relationship reminds us that even intractable conflicts contain moments of possibility. Behind rigid ideologies and political posturing lie paths to engagement for those with courage to find them. Perhaps most importantly, dialogue, even when difficult or seemingly fruitless, is never wasted. Each conversation, handshake, and small agreement builds foundation for eventual larger reconciliation.